The interpretation is important because I think to be a Christian is to be free to attend to something that's significant joyfully. To be a Christian is to attend to something that's significant joyfully. And the question is, what is significant? There are lots of problems about attending to anything with joy. Let us freely and with zest and fervor. But if the issue is what is significant, then the question is how you determine what significance is. And I think what is significant depends upon your interpretation of where we are. Now, yesterday I said that you cannot define necessity as we define it. You can't define it as we define it. If you're defining necessity the way we define it, you're saying that all the world needs what we have. If you're really defining necessity the way we define it, you're saying all the world needs what we have. I'll just take one illustration of what that means. We use 6 billion barrels of oil a year. 6 billion barrels of oil a year. We're 6% of the population. If all the world used as much oil as we use a year, that'd be 100 billion barrels of oil a year. The present estimated reserves, according to some, are 660 billion. That's 6.6 years of oil. There's just something wrong, I say, about a civilization that requires for its necessity, what we call necessity, basic needs. There's just something wrong with a civilization, I think, that requires the kinds of things which you cannot affirm and advocate and suggest to the rest of the world. To be human, then, does not mean to be what we are, because other people can't be what we are. There's just no possible way that I can see. Now, I may be wrong about that, but that's the way I see it. So if our image of success in this country is to serve the system which defines necessity the way we define it, then we're kidding ourselves about being useful and important and needed by filling an important role in our society which provides this kind of necessity for people. In other words, which defines necessity the way we define it. And I'm saying that most of what we use in this country is included in our definition of what we need, of what we really need. What's needed in order to be human? In order to be human. Now, this is an interpretation. That's why it's important for you to get this paper at the end of the hour. And if there aren't enough, we'll make some more. We'll just staple some more. Because it gives 5 interpretations of how you might look at our present situation. And mine is only 1. So yesterday I said that Christian freedom involves freedom from the tyranny of necessity. Necessity defined the way we define it. Now let me hasten to add that we're never free from necessity. That is to say, we are never free from the need to supply ourselves with that which reproduces ourselves or is the basis for our survival. But I was saying yesterday, following Marcuse, that we live in a world of artificial wants. What the myth is that we choose what we want. And what I was saying, Marcuse's thesis is that we want what the system socializes us, conditions us, encourages us, wants us to want. We don't know what we want, really. And that means that you have to say there's a kind of basic you that wants some things, and then there's a socialized you that wants some things. And we're largely determined by the socialized I or the me. I guess the way I would put it to ask the question is, what would you do if you chose to do what you wanted to do without any reference to income? What would you do if you did not need to earn anything? What would you do if you retired today? And I put it in a kind of cryptic remark, to be born is to retire. And perhaps I should say, to be born again is to be free from the tyranny of necessity. That's really what I was saying. To be born again is to be free from the tyranny of necessity. Now, when I say tyranny, I'm saying, maybe it's the ambiguity of necessity, but something is necessary for us to survive. The question is whether what we think is necessary, what we've been conditioned to think is necessary, is necessary. The question is the content of the realm of necessity. I'm not questioning the fact that we need some things. And then I went on to point out yesterday that the tyranny of necessity led to a tyranny of technology, a tyranny of technique, a tyranny of science or the scientific, a tyranny of the technicians, the technocrats, and a tyranny of an educational system, which is merely the door to this whole realm of necessity. That is, it's a door to performing a role in a system the necessity of which is very questionable in my mind. That is, the content of necessity is the issue. It's very difficult, therefore, to find roles in the society, I think, which are really satisfying if you take the position I do, because you know you're serving wants which are artificially created. It doesn't matter where you are, almost. I don't know very many roles. Now, that's an interpretation. And I emphasize that over and over again. It's just where I am. It's just the way I look at life. It's not meant to be threatening to anybody. It's not meant to be taken without discussion and without putting it over against some other interpretations, which I try to do in this paper. Now, I thought before we went on to the next topic, we would spend a little time maybe on clarification or on your reaction to this statement or the statement of an alternative interpretation of where we are and what's at stake, which would then help us think through, you know, where we are. That is, may well be that things are not the way I say they are. The issue is different. And I think some of you think it is, and I really appreciate the chance to put this interpretation in some dialogue with other people. Then we'll move on to the what I call the tyranny of creativity, of self-creativity, which is the second topic.
Somebody left a question yesterday that we were going to pick up today.
Well, somebody else will have a question.
Yes. Is this some, are you suggesting some sort of giant hoax played on us by, you know, science and technology and advertising? That if, you know, we satisfy material wants and cleaner teeth and no ring around the collar and, you know, all the rest, that this is what takes to satisfy people?
I don't know whether I'd put it as a hoax, Erling. I think different times teach us new duties. There's some sort of a hymn that goes that way. It is.
So I can plug in here that sort of the old Vance Packer hidden persuaders thing about advertising, making necessities out of luxuries.
Well, I don't know whether it's Vance Packard or not.
Well, he's popularized it.
Yeah, I know. It's,
I tend to be sympathetic because I'm just wondering why there isn't more reaction against this sense of material well-being as the chief aim in life.
Well, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, I did agree that the enormously high and wasteful standard of living, measured against the rest of the world, with only a couple other exceptions, some of the other industrialized countries, it's not only wrong, but it's immoral, and it's so short-sighted that there may not, I don't know, like 6 years, but there may not be that much, time left. I'm just wondering why responsible people can't get the American public more, aroused or concerned over what seems to be such a rapid depletion of resources. Is it the political system that we don't vote in political leaders who tell us, bad news? Is that one of the reasons that we're in this mess?
Well, yesterday I said it wasn't a political problem, it wasn't an economic problem, it wasn't a social problem, it wasn't a cultural problem, it was a religious problem. It was a sense of the meaning of our existence, what with the content of it, so that it's not an easy problem to deal with or even to understand when you grow up in the West. As a matter of fact, I would go on to say there's probably a Western problem.
Yeah.
In the sense that, and it's a very deep theological issue as to, as we get into it today, in terms of the meaning of the fulfillment of potentiality. It's a very, so that it's not a question of the hoax. I think we buy into it with great seriousness, and the question is whether or not we can find our way out of it. And I don't mean to find our way out of it simply by saying it's all junk, but to understand the meaning of it, why we do it, and then maybe be a little free to do it in a different way, or not to buy in quite so thoroughly. Rich, you want somebody back here?
Yeah, you covered it, but it seems like what...
We can't hear, Rich.
What it sounds like is the American dream. And, it's not an individual kind of thing, it is a collective kind of thing. That if you don't buy into it, you're somehow not contributing to a collective good, or people will suffer if you don't buy a car this year. People will be put out of work. If you don't burn so much stuff, other people will be hurting. That to become a part of the American dream means to buy into a thing which is hooked up not just simply with your own set of needs and wants, but a kind of great good which makes the whole thing terribly... You said it wasn't political or maybe ethical or moral, but at least part of the buying in process seems to be that.
Well, yeah, that is to do something significant is to contribute to our social system. If the content of our social system is there's the whole thing. If the content is questionable, then it's very difficult. You can't not buy in. some of the countercultural people have tried not to buy in, somehow by withdrawing. Well, I think that's futile myself. It's significant symbolically, raises a question, but you got to buy into some system, I say. You got to buy into life, to our common life, to a public life, to history. And the question is, what history do you buy into if you think somehow your history has, for some reason, gone in a direction which has got to change fairly radically?
Al, maybe the reason people aren't buying in is, be, you know, is at the root of the problem, is that we're not buying in as individuals anymore. We're involved in some kind of group dynamic that, you know, when we talk about Marcuse's thing, I mean, this is what he's saying, is that it, we're not thinking about what we're buying into. We're just buying into it. We're not acting as individuals anymore. I mean, anytime you have to develop in psychology concept of a needs assessment plan, you know, if it is people, we got to go get some kind of a machinery to decide what we need. I think we've stopped functioning as the individuals that we can function as. If we've got to set up an arbitrary way of finding out what we want, and maybe this is, you know, part of the real problem, we're not functioning as individuals anymore.
Well, ideally, well, don't you think, George, ideally you wouldn't function kind of as individuals. Your society would socialize you, and all the images, the symbols would create in you a certain psyche, certain self, you can use all kinds of words, which would fit into the system. One of the, if you take some sociological analyses, the deviants are those who don't fit in the system. They haven't been adequately socialized. The problem, therefore, in Parsons, let's take the most favorite social scientist taught in all the colleges, and that seems to me is just, you know, he's antithetical to my position. I don't see how a Christian could teach him except to know the enemy, but that's strong language. I'm trying to indicate the significance of my analysis to what it does to kinds of things that are happening all over the world and in educational institutions of which many of you have participated. His analysis would be, well, we haven't adequately socialized people. The problem today, he says it in his last book, is the problem is social. We haven't socialized people. The gangs, the criminals, they haven't been adequately socialized. They haven't been brought into the society. I'm saying the issue is the society and its values, what we call ethos, great big word, nobody knows what it means. But we use it because it's easier to use it, and then people don't ask you so much until they get courage or even know what it means. But it's kind of what you think is the way to do things and the things that ought to be done. And if that's the issue, then you see it isn't a matter of socialization. That's why education becomes so important, and it's so ambiguous today. I don't know what to do in education. If I were educating kids, and it's very strange, my first two kids were not ambiguous. I got ambiguous, and the last two were. And the first two kind of, they had trouble going through, you know, the, and just taking things in stride the way you're expected to do and the way everybody does and the way you get unhappy if your kids don't do it. And the last two, yeah. And I don't know whether they reflect my ambiguity, but if you get ambiguous about it, then how do you function? Very difficult. Then you become individual. And then it's a problem because you feel like a deviant, and you are a deviant. You're deviant in terms of the social standards.
What if we weren't somehow consuming all the oil? Would this still be a... And I think the world has benefited greatly from what we've done in the United States and will continue to benefit. But the whole problem comes when we're using a resource that's not renewable. I mean, from the standpoint of energy, let's say, because this is the biggest thing we consume.
Oil, I think, is only, I only use oil.
Yeah, well, it's because it's non-renewable.
Yeah. I would think it only suggests the problem, actually. It's a dramatic way to suggest a problem. But the real problem is not oil. It's why we need the oil. What functions oil performs for us. Where is the meaning structure in our existence which causes us to want so much? It's the meaning I'm interested in. Why do we do what we do?
I'd like to say something on that.
Yeah.
I'd like to say this, that my recollection that if the United States is not the most powerful, the most wealthy, and the most strong nation on earth, this whole world would go communist. We are the absolute formidable barrier against world equity. And one of the major contributions of, I think, why we are as well Christians is because we are a haven for God's people. We have 51% of the Jews all over the world, right in our own country.
51%
Yes.
Of what?
Of the Jews, God's people. And in God told Adam, he says, whoever treats me right, I will do the same. Treats his people. If you don't believe it, take a look what has happened to Europe and also in Russia. Any country that has mistreated the Jews, they go down the tube.
That's true. Why does Kuwait have more money than anybody else in the world?
Their time will come. Maybe. If you don't believe me, take a look at Ezekiel 38 sometime.
Jerry, you want to say something before?
Oh, yeah. I was wondering to know.
We'll come back to that. That's go ahead. I want to get your other point in here.
What is necessity and what is excess? It seems kind of hard to identify that, because it seems to me that, you know, like one man's meat is another man's poison, and what I need, somebody else doesn't. And so, I mean, do we all need to live in singular private dwellings with a yard, a lawn, or maybe just better stick to apartments because apartments are more efficient and it uses less energy and so forth?
Our nation begins right in the home. If you don't have that, you don't have a nation.
Home doesn't need a yard.
Mm-hmm. I live in apartments and I didn't trust them.
Well, that's your privilege, you know, that's your choice. Maybe other people like them.
Yeah,
Some people like them because they don't have to take care of a yard. Other people want a house because they want to take care of a yard. They need a yard.
I have two principles now in discussion. One is that we accept what other people say as an alternate interpretation, which has to be taken seriously, really taken seriously and examined. And the other is we talk about our own interpretations, as we talk about what we think and how we see it, and not about somebody out there. And so if we could just follow that.
Could I ask a question? Now, I know, you know, it's minor, but let's say in the choices that we have as consumers, for instance, I would really like to buy a washing machine that will last at least 25 years. I'd be perfectly happy with a 25-year-old washing machine if it worked. But the companies who build them built in obsolescence. The repairman comes out and says, lady, it's going to cost you more to fix this than you can replace it for. And what do you do when you don't have a choice except to buy that kind of washing machine? And I don't want to pound all the clothes on rocks to get them clean.
Go to the laundromat.
You buy it.
I want to talk about this matter of kind of a greed that really has overtaken our whole society. It's a need to possess more and more things. And I'm on the treadmill too, so I'm not accusing anybody, but I think this is a real problem. There's a real kind of a feeling of greed, a need to want to possess more and more and more things. People don't hesitate too long to get a new television set or something like that if it goes out, or items like that that may not really be necessary. And yet they'll oppose bitterly an increase in school taxes that might improve the educational opportunities, perhaps cut down the size of the load in the classroom, give more teachers and things like that. They object to their money going to an educational purpose, but they don't object to buying a television set instead. And I think what we should head toward is an overall look at our values to see just what is it that's important. Is television set more important than, for example, education? I even
kind of raised my eyebrows at this purchase of the piano for Holden here. You know, is that really as necessary as perhaps some services as against a thing?
Well, you know, piano represents creativity, the arts, which some Lutherans are very high on, and that's the second topic. It's involved in the second topic.
I can take it.
But we'll talk about greed. Yeah, I think the question is, why do people want to watch television? I mean, you were asking about fulfillment, the image of fulfillment. That's really what we're asking about. And as I said, I must have said yesterday, this working class community watches 17 hours a day per person. And that's part of the reality. And most people would say if you only work 30 hours a week, people wouldn't know what to do the rest of the time. And there's one company that's on a 4-day week, 10 hours a day, up in Edmonton, is trying to program the company personnel for meaningful existence those other 3 days. And it's not simply to keep them out of trouble, because they have a vision of human life which is freer than our present. But I asked somebody yesterday after the meeting, what would you do if you didn't work 8 hours a day? I frequently ask myself in years gone by, what would I do if I didn't work 50 or 60 hours at my university job? And the only way you know is if you stop working. And I can remember exactly when I stopped working on Sunday. And then I had time to write to my kids and do a lot of other things I hadn't done before, because I would work on Sunday. Now, if you just cut that down about 2 more days, then you'd have to ask yourself, you know, what would you do? And then you've got the time. That's really what I'm pleading for here, is to get rid of the tyranny of necessity, to reduce our wants. And it's very difficult when you've got a whole system. Reduce the amount of money we need in order to survive, in order that we can choose to do something else with the time other than earn a living. And that's not easy, and I don't have any formula. I'm just saying we live under a tyranny, it seems to me. Marcuse's point is that at one point in history, just to survive, you had to work a lot. But we don't have to. Just to keep your body going and warmth and you know, just to keep going doesn't take many hours of work. If you could program it that way, you know, I would say that without all the rest of the stuff we now consider to be, you know, needs are really important, I would think we could program ourselves on about 20 hours. It's a little hard here and there. You'd have to work at it some. And you'd have to get rid of some of your things. Then you might educate your own kids. Or you might, together in a community, do all kinds of things that were different. And then maybe your kids wouldn't need to go to college. If they don't have to have a highfalutin, high powerful place in this institutional setup of ours, and be some great technician of some sort. I mean, I'm a technician. I'm talking about myself. Technician just in terms of philosophy and theology and social science. That's what I'm considered to be, a technician, right? If you didn't have to be that, then education would be introduction into meaningful life rather than accumulation of all of this stuff, which you know the way it goes. You've got to get good grades beginning in grade school to get to the right college, and then in college you've got to get them in order to get to the right graduate school. And it's real. My son didn't get into the right school because he just wouldn't study in economics. He got into about fourth grade school because he would not study when he didn't feel the thing was important. We'd take a D in the course.
I've got some random
questions.
Yesterday. First of all, on the last point you made, if you were to make this talk in the south side of Chicago that you made yesterday, I don't think it would have went over. I had a visual picture of Raisin in the Sun where the fellow said, man, if you say you, I gotta go drive that back car, and my mother and my wife have to go clean those toilets so that we can survive. So you have to, you're talking a second generation look at, and I can remember the third word that you used yesterday, and in my mind it came out, the tyranny of success, as far as what society is imposed on us as far as the achieving that we think we have to do materially or otherwise. In this country, we've got two basic things that have come through as general principles. One is we've been built on a growth principle. Secondly, we've built our country on competition. I would say that both of these are good, or at least they have been good so far. I think that your approach can probably come across on a personal level, assuming that you're cooling down from a position of being able to make a living relatively easily. And I think most of us here can do that. I know I can. But when you get beyond the personal and say that we have to change the entire matrix that's imposing these those needs on it, I don't know if it works or not. And maybe it will have to work in the future because we don't have this overabundance of wealth or resources, so that we've gotten ourselves into this second generation situation. Well, that's a random thought that I had. I'll throw these out and I'm going to talk about them. Your mother pushed you in school, and I couldn't tell whether you resented it or didn't. My father happened to be a barber. I put two girls through the Davis College. I worked my way through the university because we were close in age. Both my parents felt pride in the fact that they had, quote, given their kids something that they didn't have. So if you're looking at things in the longer range, maybe we do have an obligation back to those who provided something for us. Not that we shouldn't maintain an artificial situation, but maybe we don't have a right to drop out for that minor reason. Perhaps more importantly, for the major reason that the system may not work if everybody comes back.
We all go to bed.
I don't know. I haven't had time to think very thoroughly at all what you said yesterday. I think that it has a feel on a personal basis. I've only been at home a day and a half, and I'm getting to like it more. And I can't remember Magic Mountain that well. But I'm going to go back and read it. If we've got some of that policy or something. But those, you want us to be stretching up a little bit.
You're addressing everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious. If the black was sitting here like Cohen was when I proposed the same kind of thing to him, he blew his top. He had to. South Americans would blow their top too, probably mostly at this. Any developing nation, any left out group, this is addressed to you who are in this room and middle class people. Not because it isn't relevant. See, I created black millionaires. I personally was responsible for creating them. And I said, for what? For what? I called this guy one day, so what are you doing? I said, well, I'm reflecting on the state of our culture and the values of it and the meaning of it. Because I don't have time, because I'm working 18 hours a day. And he had made it because I paid the way for him to really become a participant in the construction industry in Chicago.
Some people like to work. And some people work all their lives. I came from a rural area, and only a farmer lived all their life. They dwelt about it, but...
Well, my father and I had a vacation in 25 years. I know what work is. I worked from the day school was out, and when I went to college, the day it started, something always happened in the store we owned, so I had to work the whole summer. Whatever, you know, somebody's breaking an arm or something. And so I know what work is, and I enjoy working. But the question is, what's worth working at? You got a choice.
Well, if one of your choices is that you can continue to work, maybe a lot of people would still make that choice. Maybe I'd rather work than get retired.
That same, I don't know if it's the same contractor you're talking about that I know.
No, no, it isn't. That's another one.
But that one, whom you also helped make a millionaire, and I thank you for it.
He helps his church.
Helps our church.
I hope he gives generously.
Yeah, he does. And likes to give. But he says of himself that he's only a contractor because he's black. That if he were white, he'd still be a carpenter because that's what he likes to do. But that he couldn't carpent the way he wants to carpent because he couldn't get into whatever the union was, whatever. And he had to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And run his own thing. That's what he says in reflection. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. He's a whale of a contractor.
Yeah, he works very hard.
But he loves
it. Well, yeah, he's got ulcers and a lot of other things, as you know.
Right.
He really was in a much better mood because he was always excluded from participation in the system until we helped him. And therefore, he had more of a sense of meaning, actually, as a person, because he could participate in the system. So it did help his ulcers, I think, although they kept recurring.
Well, if you carry one of the statements you made a while ago to the ultimate, where say this whole society of ours could reach the point where in 20 hours a week we could produce everything we all needed for survival, so that we had all the rest of the time to do the things we wanted to do. We reversed that coin, and what it meant to me was that during that 20 hours each week, we would not be doing the thing we wanted to do, but we would be getting engaged in occupations where we are not being fulfilled only to have all of the rest of the time to fulfill ourselves. And I would question very seriously what all this occupational activity would lead us all to as a society when we were all doing things we didn't want to do in order to find the time to do the things we wanted to do.
Well, if your 20 hours a week served the community, you really felt it served the community, it would be meaningful too. Because I think people who work in Holden feel it's meaningful because the community is meaningful and everything you do serves people. You don't feel that excess. You don't feel like you're creating a great big monstrosity of a social system with all and serving all kinds of needs and wants that are not helped. Here, everybody who does anything, I think, you feel your work is meaningful.
Don't you think most people have a job like that? Do you think a lot of people?
You think
don't
most
have a simple job?
Don't
have a feeling of how many people would really feel this way. I would think most people like their job.
Well, just read Studs Terkel's Working. Read Studs Terkel's Working. Now, I've just heard, I haven't read more than the first three or four chapters. We read them coming across the country after we finished the book on Dostoevsky. We always read to each other in the car, so we slow down. We don't mind going slowly and enjoy that long trip, 48. But, I noticed that Erling said, you read Workings, you know it, and that's a story that really you ought to read if you think people are really satisfied with their working. Now, see, maybe they're not dissatisfied. You know, maybe the high-powered executives who are running the corporations that are creating all kinds of things, which are very doubtful, you know, doubtful resources for us, like big Chrysler, or big Oldsmobile. I've got a Cutlass. I always have to explain it. It was the smallest car that a black dealer sold when I was, you know, in this business of buying black. And we were just preaching buying black, and I was in charge of getting money in the black banks and savings and loans. And I thought, well, you gotta do it. But the guy who was treasurer of Breadbasket, of course, bought a not a Cutlass. That was a small car. He bought a Cadillac. He's $1 million a year insurance salesman, so he could afford it. But it was very interesting. We went to this dealer when we had a wreck, and they referred to our car, that little green car over there. Yeah.
Well, what do you drive when you got 7 people in your family?
Yeah, well, you ask the automobile manufacturers to manufacture a big car with an aluminum engine, costs you a little bit more, but it uses less gasoline because it has less weight, and they can do it. And so you have a bigger car, which is lighter and therefore gets more mileage. That's what you have to do, and I don't know how you get that done.
Well, maybe I ought to go on and throw in a little bit more. I promised you, some of you, this subject is in a way inexhaustible. We haven't dealt adequately, of course, with some of you who've raised questions that what we're doing is pretty good. What we're doing really is pretty good. It's been suggested that it contributes to the rest of the world. I don't know how our technology is relevant to most of the rest of the world. What happened in Brazil, for example, when we introduced the Green Revolution with our technology, is the rich got richer. There were more unemployed because we introduced the technology, and the wages went down. That's a fact. Our technology did not somehow help the ordinary person there. It gave income to the people who owned the land. And so there are all kinds of problems with what we have to contribute. And sometimes I say about all we have to contribute to the rest of the world right now, in terms of a pattern of life that's really relevant for them, is food. Now, we've got some other things. You might say we've got, if you're going nuclear energy, we have the capacity to provide them with nuclear energy, and I wish we had the capacity to provide them with solar energy. If we do that kind of thing with our money, you know, I could buy into it a lot better. Let me just throw out a few more things for you to think about. I've got plenty already, but for tomorrow.
What is it you want to do for them? Raise their standard up to where ours is?
For the rest of the world? Oh, provide them a meaningful way of life. Help them decide on, or, you know, work out a meaningful way of life.
When we don't know what ours is?
Well, we can't help them. All we can do is provide, you know, tools and so forth that they might be able to use in their own way. I don't think we have a meaningful way of life for the rest of the world, to tell you the truth. I don't think it's viable for the rest of the world. So the question is, what in our way of life is viable? No, so for everybody. We used to think we had a way of life that was viable for everybody, didn't we? We really thought we were setting a pattern for the rest of the world. And now I'm trying to say it's really questionable whether we have done that job and whether the future of the world doesn't belong to developing nations which take a different path than we have taken in terms of the whole realm of necessity. And maybe they have to take different paths in other ways, but certainly that's what I'm trying to say. It doesn't seem to be a viable, if you look at what we have and the way things are happening in this country, and we'll talk a little tonight about China and what's happening in China, according to some interpretation, I don't know who knows, but maybe we have to do considerable rethinking. Certainly we don't have a lot to export. And the gentleman who said that
the rest of the world is going Marxist. I don't know whether it's communist, Marxist, Maoist. Mao is different from Marx. But it's going socialist. That's a big word, too. But certainly it's not buying into our way of doing things. And why are they going that way? Why are they going that way? If everything we have is really so relevant and so accessible, well, a lot of different reasons. We will get into that tonight in the forum on China, very definitely, because I'm going to chair it. And we're going to ask, what's the meaning of China for us? What's it saying to us about our own style of life? And I know I have less information on that than I do about America. Therefore, I can talk more freely. The second thing I wanted to talk about was labor. I mean, was work. Where in labor, we've been talking about what is necessary to reproduce ourselves, to survive. And that we produce things that we use up. In work, we produce things that have a lasting, longer life, at least. Art objects, products that have a lasting life. That are used up over a longer period of time. And I think the issue here is that we have a tyranny of what I call creativity. You get tired of tyranny. Let me say they're dialectical always. Wherever I'm saying it's tyrannous, I'm also saying there's a value. It's a question of it being lifted up and emphasized too much. The tyranny of creativity, where the focus is on the product. Where it's on the book or the painting or, I suppose, a tool that can be used over a long period of time. The focus is on the present as a means to the future. It's on instrumental value. When you're creating a product, what's important is to get the product is over against the experience. Joan Anderson was talking about writing, and Rich was talking about painting, and they both seem to have the same idea. But it wasn't the painting or the writing, it was the experience of creating. It wasn't the product somehow, it was something else that was involved in the very making of something. This may appear to be a little mixed up. It's a little mixed up in my own mind. But what it really seems to me to be is the tyranny of the new. The myth is that the new is better than the old. The myth, I think, is that there will always be a future. Why do we cover over death and our finitude so much? I think we act always somehow as if we're preparing for the future. My dad worked 25 years without a vacation. He finally took a few days vacation. He retired in March at the age of 60 and died in September. And I don't know why he worked so hard. Maybe he didn't know anything else to do. But I think we live somehow as if there will always be a future. And somehow we've always got to prepare for that future. And at least I think some people are living in order to retire. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe they don't want to retire. Maybe I know retirement is a great threat to a lot of people. I think we have the myth that to shape or make is better than to receive. To shape or make is better than to receive. In other words, it's really better to make something. It's better to paint a picture or to weave a hanging rather than to, in some way, enjoy a picture that somebody else has painted. It's better to be making things. And I think I can illustrate that in terms of preaching. I think a good many sermons are terrible. They're awful. Spent a whole year trying to help our preacher think through his sermons one night a week so he has something in him. And why didn't he take some decent sermons and preach them? You know, why do you have to create a sermon every week? It's a tremendous responsibility to be creative and funny and you know, all the rest of the stuff you're supposed to be. Um,
this notion of living somehow in terms of the next is over against savoring and experiencing what we experience in the present. Living for the future, I think it can be illustrated by conversation. Well, it'd be illustrated best by a preacher. Somebody said the other day, he's shaking your hand, you know, as you go by and talking, saying hello to the next person. Now, what else can he do? But he's not attending to you, in a sense. And frequently, I find myself that way. Frequently in conversations, I don't attend to it. I'm thinking about some other conversation I wish I were in, or something, you know. Next time you want to talk to me, I suppose. But how do you listen? To listen, you've got to put the future out, and you've got to put lots of things out, and you've got to attend to that present situation as if it's important. Now, I think the tyranny really becomes that we have a theory that we have to actualize all potentiality individually. That is, we got a lot of potentiality, and we ought to actualize it. Partly it's due to our individualism. And we think somehow we're contributing to God's life by actualizing all the potentiality in ourselves. And so we really think, and our kids too. I'm it's very ambiguous, because we would not insist that our kids play. It's terrible, probably, because now they don't play. You know, we just would not send them the music lessons and all that thing if somehow it didn't fit into the schedule. We just weren't going to put them under all that pressure. Now, maybe they regret it. I don't know. But the question is, what is the meaning of this when we die? Every person starts over again. Well, so you start over again creating something new. You got all these potentialities, and every person somehow, you just start over again creating all these potentialities. And there are so many books. I use this, of course, to excuse why I don't write books. There's so many books, why write another? Man, there are a lot of books. And a lot of terrible books. One person said of one person I know, written 25 books, not a good book there, and there won't be a good book. No, why do we write them? So I write it. My potentiality somewhere is in that product. Now, I think what I'm trying to say, and it's very fuzzy here, although I've got a hold of some of these things, I think, a little bit, just a little piece of them. We do not need to create anything new to participate in the real, to have meaning. Meaning and being are given. And part of it is in the way we conceive of God, and this really gets abstract, but if we conceive of God as complete actuality, if you participate in God, then you participate in actuality. That's one way of looking at it. If you take a doctrine of God that many people are now fussing over, in which God enjoys our creativity and grows, actually, then he's not complete actuality, then you assume a somewhat different position. Namely, participation in God, you could say, is to participate in all of the actualizations of everyone, including yourself. Now, the first view of God, in which he's complete actuality, and this is a great debate in the history of theology, if you participate in God, therefore you participate in the actualization of all potentiality, therefore you're not required to actualize your potentiality yourself. Now, if you assume that you participate in God, and by participating in God, that is, by living in him and he in you, living in him is a very kind of arrogant view, but at least he lives in you, you might say, more, what, humble. Then, insofar as other people live in him, you participate in every actualization that goes on. You don't have to fulfill all your potentialities for potentiality. Everybody is fulfilling potentiality. There's actualizing potentiality. You are the other. Now, this requires a breakdown in our individualistic notion, and I'll talk about that tomorrow at the end of the hour, probably, because you may want to think about this and talk about it the first period. So what we assume in terms of what we are, that life is a task. It's a task of actualizing potentiality, as over against life is a gift. Now, if you take my dialectical view, life is both a gift and a task. The problem being with us is that we conceive it largely as a task and not a gift. Our being is something we create and make, as over against a gift to us, which we receive, participate in, and therefore are without ever lifting our finger. We think we are the agent for all actualization, as over against God being the agent of actualization, and therefore actualizing things that are important without our having to be completely responsible for it. Well, it's time to call us to a close. I hope you like the style a little of talking first and then throwing some things out for you to think about. That it gives you all a chance to think, and when you come back tomorrow, you'll have a chance to say some things. And I welcome more speeches than we had today, actually.